Hello there. For this week's bonus content, we have the rest of our two interviews with lawyer Ryan Davidson, whom you've heard in the last couple episodes. Ryan reached out to us in February because he had some critiques of how he thought we were characterizing Covenant Seminary in terms of how they have or haven't responded over the years and the legal advice they might be following around that issue. We asked Ryan if he'd be interested in doing an interview about that and other topics, and he agreed. Ryan's voice turned out to be incredibly valuable for providing some legal context around the fallout from Elizabeth's murder, and he really added a lot to those last couple episodes. We say at the end of every episode that anyone with any information related to Elizabeth or her murder is welcome to contact us, and we really mean that, even for people who have critiques of what we're doing. So with that, we bring you Ryan Davidson.
A persistent theme in the podcast has been people asking, why are we not talking about this? Yeah, I remember now what exactly motivated me to first reach out. It was with Pastor Hackman talking about a perceived need for pastors in general. This is probably not limited to the PCA, but clergy to know when to and how to rely on outside experts to make use of expertise outside their own. And I'm thinking to myself, if the seminary has received anything remotely like the evidence that would have been coming from their legal advisors and also sort of risk management, they wouldn't talk about it. So it sounds to me like, actually, especially given when this happened, which is now more than 30 years ago, the advice they would have heard is don't talk about this. It will do more harm than good. You're going to potentially expose the seminary to legal risk. And this is an open murder investigation, and the police are actively looking for someone to charge. Even if, you know, especially if you didn't do it, you know, being charged with murder is a life-changing event. So you want to be really careful about that in general. And in this case, again, I haven't seen all the material that you have, and I'm sure there's material you would still like to see that you haven't. But it sounds like there's reason to wonder about the direction and efficacy of the police work, which would only heighten the sense of we need to not talk about this. And it just didn't seem to me like that urgency was coming through in the discussions you were having with the various people you've interviewed.
Okay, so we talked about this idea of civil liability and how an institution, especially, you know, in 1990 was probably trying to weigh whether it had done everything right. And the goal of an internal investigation is often to see if there were any gaps and things that need to be fixed. Does that question of legal liability extend to today? Does it extend forever?
So the answer is yes, but maybe not in the way that most people would think. In the immediate aftermath of an incident, yeah, legal liability is always a question. But civil liability for a particular incident, there's an end date on that. Claims have a sell-by date. The statute of limitations is real. You don't bring a claim that you're aware of by a certain amount of time, you lose it. But when you're bringing a civil case against someone for an injury, a tort, you know, a civil wrong that serves as the basis for a lawsuit, there's going to be an intent element there like there is in the criminal context. They did it deliberately, okay, you know, fine. Most of the time, that's not what we're talking about. Most of the time, it's something that happened by accident. So the question is, were they negligent? You know, did they fail to exercise reasonable care? And one of the ways that you establish that is to look at the defendant's attitude toward risk. And one of the ways you do that is inquire about previous incidents. Because if they were aware that something was a problem and didn't do anything about it, or their, you know, remediation was not adequate in light of the magnitude of the risk, that looks bad. And looking bad is what gets defendants found liable for wrongs.
And it could be something totally unrelated, right?
Completely unrelated. Or rather, sort of factually unrelated. You know, an incident that happens tomorrow that has nothing whatsoever to do with Elizabeth, her murder might actually be relevant background in terms of the seminary's approach to risk, you know, the measures they take to handle that. And that never goes away. But there's one other side of this. This is a murder investigation, and murder doesn't have a statute. You can always bring a murder charge. So something that we've seen over the last 20 years about allegations of sexual abuse is a push to try and talk about some of these things because there was no legal liability, civil or criminal. It had all happened so long ago that legislatures had to actively change the law to make it possible for alleged victims to bring claims. That's not a problem with murder. The police could charge somebody tomorrow, and there wouldn't be a timing problem with that. So in a lot of other situations, we get to a place where, okay, this was a long time ago. It's safe to talk about this legally because there aren't going to be any legal consequences. That is absolutely not the case here.
For not just the defendant, you're saying, but also for anyone else involved in the institution?
Potentially, and not necessarily because they were directly involved. But one of the reasons that we didn't talk about that you don't want to talk to the police is if they decide you're lying, they can charge you with that. So what possible upside could there be to talking about this? Especially as it seems like there's only ever been a single suspect and there's reason to question the competency of the police work there. If the relationship between Michael and the seminary has been strained thus far, like, what's going to happen if they have a memorial service, there's a police officer in the background or reporter in the background, and word gets back to the investigating officers, and then they bring charges for something? Who knows?
Well, so talk to me about how you kind of hold that tension, if you can. You're a lawyer. You're also a member of a PCA church. How do you kind of balance those competing, or maybe you don't see them as competing, interests of protecting yourself, but also, hey, I believe in objective truth and justice? How do you think through that?
That question would be a lot easier to answer if we weren't talking about a murder case. So, you know, think about it this way. A way of sort of judging the severity of a criminal charge is by how much a private criminal defense attorney is going to charge you to defend the case. DUI, first time, $1,500, maybe $2,000. Take it to trial, maybe you're talking, you know, 5 to 10. Low-level felony, $10,000-$15,000. Murder, how much money do you have? Okay, all of that, and we might need more. There is no bigger criminal risk than that. And yeah, we believe in the need for repentance and the need for, well, justice. But justice is not something that Covenant Seminary was ever going to be able to give here. It's not really what they're for. If we want justice for a criminal wrong, in a way, blood calls for blood. We see in the Old Testament, in the Mosaic Law, if someone kills someone else, well, the dead guy's family, they have an avenger of blood, and he goes out and he collects scalps. This is a way of getting out of hand. This is how blood feuds start. But in the absence of a centralized authority that can do justice, there aren't really any other options. Okay, well, we have one of those centralized authorities. And the deal is we don't start familial blood feuds because we have the police to take care of that. If they don't, justice will have to wait for the great day, right? There's nothing really to be done in the meantime. Whoever did this should obviously confess and repent, but one imagines that if they were going to do that, they would have done so by now. Who knows, they may have privately to a, you know, clergy of their choice. That would be privileged. But given the downside risk, the magnitude of the risk, and the knowledge that there are questions about the way the police are handling this, it's hard to say that the prudent thing for the seminary to do is to talk about this much. That doesn't mean that individuals there can't pray for her and pray that the case would be solved. If there are people that have been in a position to do that and haven't, and are now complaining that the seminary isn't doing anything about it. It's like, well, I mean, that was always within your power. It's not really a great look to blame people who have very tangible reasons for keeping their silence when you were always free to do the things you're saying should have been happening. But in terms of high standards, like, well, that doesn't extend to the solving the case when the police can't do it. Like I said before, there's really no good options here. Given that a woman was murdered, that makes sense. Given that it's an open murder investigation, yeah, no one's going to want to talk about this. So it's really, really hard to credit anyone trying to say this says bad things about Covenant. I mean, I have my own frustrations with leadership in the PCA, believe you me. This is not one of them.
Okay, so let me ask you this about the shoddy police work. So I know that in that document, there's at least the one reference. I think it's in Norm Steimel's first letter. It might have been on May 16th, the week that Michael moved out. He makes some reference to, I don't know if he used the word botched, but some reference to, like, basically the police botched it. At the time, I mean, I guess Covenant administrators, they're interacting with the police, and so maybe they're getting a sense of, like, you know, this isn't the sharpest group of guys, like, they're just personal interactions, but they wouldn't have necessarily been privy to the hundreds of pages of reports that were flying back and forth and seeing those misconnections.
So when you say they, do you specifically mean the Covenant administration?
Yes, yeah. So, like, you know, so if the premise of your argument is, well, if Covenant and Michael both could have focused on, really, this is all the fault of the police because they latched onto Michael, but how many, you know, details of, like, crappy police work would they really have even been privy to other than knowing it wasn't solved?
In terms of the details of the police investigation, they wouldn't have been privy to, say, the documents there. Attorney Steimel, Michael's attorney, made a comment in one of his letters that the police are clearly not sharing information with him. And that's presumably accurate. That's what one would expect. And they're not going to share it with the seminary either. But if you read Steimel's correspondence, it's clear as early as April 1990, and certainly by May 1990, that he is already convinced this investigation is not being handled well. And even in the absence of full access to the police records, the defense attorney involved in a case like this can get a good read on that. If nothing else, Steimel knows the police have no meaningful physical evidence. By May 16th, there's already been a grand jury that's been impaneled and that has declined to indict, which is kind of remarkable. The old saying is that a skilled prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Well, it didn't happen here. So, wow. But apart from just the murder not being solved, the police are no less interested in Michael than when they started. In fact, every additional, I don't know if you can call it revelation, but piece of data, development in the case that either arguably looks good for Michael or seems irrelevant to Michael, they're focusing on him even more. This looks like what in other contexts might be called target fixation. They're so focused on Michael that even if someone in Steimel's position doesn't know what the other potential suspects might be, it's already clear the police are not going to be looking at them. They're not looking at them. Somewhere in Steimel's correspondence was a line to the effect that, you know, despite police statements that they're looking at other suspects, we don't believe that. Turns out he's probably right. So everything that Steimel predicted about the way this investigation was going to develop turns out to have been more or less correct. In his April letter, where he's talking to Michael about the decision to take the polygraph, he says, this is not going to make your situation better. If you quote unquote fail the polygraph, all right, well, then you're guilty. If you quote unquote pass the polygraph, oh, you manipulated the test. That's exactly what happened. And just the amount of time and resources that the police were expending going after Michael just makes it clear they're not doing anything else. So if the question is, you know, how could anyone have known that there were problems with the police work? Well, Steimel did, and he told people.
Let me play devil's advocate, though. He's Michael's defense attorney. Of course, he's going to be motivated to find holes in the police work. You know, I would think any competent defense attorney would try to undercut the police narrative. So isn't he a little biased there?
He's interested, certainly. But once everything he says, look, this is how this is going to go down. Once things go down that way, you have to start listening. Yes, he's his defense attorney. If he believes that Michael is guilty, he's not going to say that. But he's also probably not going to talk the way that he does. And we just read from his April 20th letter. As near as we were able to determine, the police will not be able to break this case unless there is either an outright confession or unless they are able to build a circumstantial case against you using inconsistencies and contradictions, the various statements you've provided. My concern with the polygraph test is not with its results, but with its use as a means of simply obtaining another statement from you. If the police had physical evidence, he would know about it. They would tell him. They have to, if this is going to go anywhere. If there was enough evidence to make an even plausible case, the grand jury probably would have indicted. That's what you would expect them to do. So no, you don't really have to take Steimel's word for it as such, because by May, the grand jury has already turned the case down. And yet, the Creve-Coeur Police Department never changed their focus.
Continuing to play devil's advocate here, presumably there are some cases that slip through the cracks such that even the best investigators on planet Earth would not be able to solve it because it's 1990 and standards of evidence are different and there's no DNA evidence at the time. And, you know, maybe the killer just was meticulous and there wasn't a drop of DNA that would have been able to convict anyone even by 2024 technology standards. And so this was just one that was like almost literally impossible to solve. Let's say we get to the point where the grand jury decides not to indict. At that point, is like, would the proper move then be for the police just to drop it and leave Michael alone? Presumably, they're not acting in bad faith. They're not trying to pin it on a person they willfully know to be innocent. Let's just presume that they genuinely believe that Michael is guilty. So what should they have done differently?
Right. So here we, you know, come across the notion that it's possible to be both sincere and dishonest, in that you can genuinely believe something to be true, but that belief can be based on I won't necessarily say subconscious, but a refusal to give the evidence that you have a fair reading.
Or is it that in this case, there's like a lack of evidence, so there's nothing to read, so it's like they're reading too much into evidence that isn't there?
Yes, but also in particular, as has been discussed, the police have been trained to interpret things as evidence that aren't. And they're inferring guilt all over the place on the level of human interactions that isn't evidence. It's never admissible in the first place, and we know definitely with hindsight, but even at the time, this stuff is not reliable. Polygraphs have never been admissible. The techniques that they're predicated on have never been admissible. The police are still using them and are still drawing sincere conclusions from those when they really shouldn't be. It's hard to fault the officers as such. This is what they were trained to do, but they shouldn't have been. And I haven't seen the police file. Not sure how much of it you've seen, but the lack of any substantive physical forensic evidence here is very mysterious. I know that Michael submitted to a collection of hair samples and fingernail scrapings. So if there was anything at the scene of the crime that would biologically tie him to it, it's reasonable to believe that the police would have found it. Or whoever did it was very, very, very careful. Almost preternaturally careful. And two things about that. First, I'm not sure that idea fits particularly well with the police's theory of the case as far as Michael goes. My understanding is that they kind of think of him as a guy that has a hot temper that can lose control. If so, that's not the kind of mindset one expects to result in a pristine crime scene. So they don't have any forensic evidence from the crime scene. Okay. We know that they conducted a search of Michael's belongings and an inspection of Michael himself. Didn't come up with anything. That means either there was nothing for them to come up with, there was, and they botched it, or I don't know what. But none of the evidence that you would expect them to find if Michael was the perpetrator was ever discovered. Some of that, again, given the paramedics, is not going to really be the police's fault. Contamination of a crime scene is like, that happens, there's really nothing to be done about it. But I can't speak to the skill with which what evidence was still available was collected. I have no insight into what kind of tests and evidence they were looking for when they examined Michael's belongings, but clearly they didn't find what they were looking for. Because if they had, we'd know. So what then can the police's belief that Michael was the perpetrator be based on? They didn't like the cut of his jib? I don't know. But it's nothing tangible. You know, if it boils down to, we just thought he acted guilty, get that out of here. That is not legitimate. But they never back off of it. As far as I can tell, they're still on that. And this is despite the grand jury refusing to indict. And then years later, the prosecuting attorney taking a look at it and said, yeah, look, there's nothing here. So could the police have come up with something if they'd followed other leads? That's possible. I don't know what leads those would have been.
They did look into several other students on campus. None as stringently as they looked into Michael, but they did. There were a couple guys that have a lot of paperwork in the police report. Now, none of them had serious, you know, they either had alibis or there was just even less evidence, air quotes, than they had for Michael. But, you know, there were other suspects that they at least somewhat looked into.
But then, so let's just consider the idea of, so how does everyone else respond to the fact that, you know, if I'm correct, and if Attorney Steinman was correct back in the 90s, that this police investigation is not going well. And if we're wondering why Elizabeth's killer hasn't been identified and brought to justice, they may have something to do with it. Not deliberately, but this investigation was headed the wrong direction. Okay, so what does it mean for everybody else? Well, for Michael, it really underlines the notion that he has absolutely nothing to gain from talking to the police. And it seems that by the middle of 1990, when he declined to cooperate with Covenant's investigation, he had come around to his attorney's perspective on that. It's like, no, nothing I say can help me because the police don't want it to. What I don't see is any indication that people associated with the seminary side of things came around to that perspective. This was a long time ago. I was not privy to those conversations, but from the documents that I have seen and the sort of allusions that those documents make to other lines of communication, that just doesn't seem to be an issue that the seminary wanted to deal with. And on one hand, what were they supposed to do? They can't make the police do their job better. If the Covenant administration becomes convinced that the police are part of the problem, that's not going to make the police happy. And now people are going to raise questions. Well, why aren't you cooperating with the police? Well, because the police are doing a bad job. But that's hard to negotiate. And you can easily invite, oh, so what do you have to hide? Why are you helping hide the murderer? It's not fair, but that happens. But I also think that, again, there was enough information available to them for them to have a clear sense that there's something wrong with this investigation. Maybe we need to cut Michael some slack here. On the flip side, maybe he needs to cut the seminary some slack as well. The police's fixation on Michael puts both Michael and the seminary in an impossible position, because Michael knows I am now the prime suspect in a murder case, and as far as I can tell, I'm always going to be. There's nothing I can do to change that. Anything I say will make things worse. But the seminary can, first off, take that to heart, understand Michael's position is like, yeah, he can't say anything. Even if he's innocent, and even if we believe he's innocent, him talking to us isn't going to help. But they also can't probably provide him the kind of references that he wants. The seminary is aware that Michael is a murder suspect. Even if they disagree with that and think it's unjust and incorrect, the fact is still there. And you read through the correspondence from Dr. Koistra, and he's quite clear. Look, this is what the police are telling us. Whether we believe it kind of doesn't matter, because we have to take it into consideration and demonstrate we're taking it seriously. If both the seminary and Michael and his family could come around to the idea that many of the problems in this multi-decade story may be attributable to bad police work and or the inadvertent contamination of the scene by the paramedics, maybe some of the acrimony can be let go and reconciled. Nobody was going to get what they wanted out of this, but it's not Michael's fault and it's not the seminary's fault. And then for anyone else looking at the case, again, recognize that neither of these parties really had many real choices. Now, I don't think the seminary did itself any favors in some of the way it communicated with Michael. There definitely seems to be some ambiguity or confusion, particularly between the messages that Mark Bells was sending and, say, the messages that Dr. Koistra was sending. Those don't seem entirely consistent. So the seminary was clearly giving Michael bad advice and doesn't seem to have really internalized the possibility that maybe this police investigation is going nowhere. Maybe they did. I can't tell. I haven't seen any documents to that effect. It's possible. But it doesn't show up in their communication with Michael. But something I haven't heard from anybody talking about this is how to wrestle with the problem. Okay, you know, the police are the ones with the authority to investigate crimes. It is not just their job to investigate this murder, but really, they're the only ones with the authority, with the power to do that. If they make a mistake or are barking up the wrong tree or headed in the wrong direction, whatever, nobody else can change that. Everyone else just has to deal with it. Or, as seems to sort of be the case in a lot of conversations in conservative circles, conservative Christian circles, just sort of, you know, blue screen of death when you raise the possibility that the authorities are wrong. There's just no way of handling that exception. But it really looks to me like that's what's going on with the police in this case. Don't have to question their sincerity. And again, given the forensic problems, it might not even be their fault, but they really should have known, as far as I can tell, that the only things they had against Michael were circumstantial, and even those circumstantial things weren't actually the evidence they thought that it was, but they just won't let it go.
But in Michael's case, he seems to have gotten the impression that Covenant was trying to relitigate the police investigation. They didn't necessarily explicitly say it, but the implications seemed to be the police screwed this up, so we're going to do our own investigation and try to solve it on our own. Or that was Michael's impression of what they were doing.
It is clear to me that that is the impression Michael got. And going back through that correspondence, it's easy to see how he could have gotten that impression. I don't know for sure whether the seminary was trying to sort of replicate the police investigation. There's statements to the effect that they're not, and that's not implausible either. Some people might wonder, well, what the heck is Covenant investigating if not trying to find the murderer? Well, quite a bit, actually. Yeah, there's a handwritten note, I think it must have been by Michael or someone connected with him, that, you know, to the effect that you can't find the cause unless you find the culprit. You know, the Covenant says, we're not out to try to find or accuse a murderer, and then someone writes on that, but doesn't that mean you have to find the murderer? Well, no, actually, it doesn't. The things that an organization in the seminary's position would want to think about are things like, is there a risk in our work rotation schedules? Should we have had more than one person assigned to be in the chapel? Should we have scheduled cleaning that early? Do we need to look into more physical security for the buildings? What's our policy about locking doors? Should we change that? All of these are the sorts of questions that an incident like Elizabeth's murder are going to bring up. I assume that Covenant and the people that conducted this investigation on its behalf were interested in those things. But there's communications, especially from the letter of from Bells on January 4th, 1991, where he talks about wanting to clear the air. You know, he suggests that the investigation has exonerated other people. Like, that really does look like they're trying to identify the murderer. Michael can absolutely be excused for thinking that's what they're trying to do. I'm not sure whether it was. I know it didn't need to be. But there's a lot of indications throughout the communications, both that I've seen and that are mentioned as having happened in person, that you could fairly read as supporting Michael's understanding that the seminary is trying to find the murderer. And the reason he doesn't want to participate in that investigation is because anything he tells them is not privileged and it will get back to the police. And we already know the police are going to interpret everything Michael says as evidence of guilt. So in Bell's letter, he says, you know, we're not representing the police. We're not going to be there. The police are not going to be there. There's no reason to think that's not true. There's also no reason to think that the police couldn't have gotten a full transcript of everything Michael said if they'd wanted to. And they did. So Michael has to assume that talking to Covenant's investigators is no different from talking to the police.
Okay. If Covenant's internal investigation was truly about their legal liability and getting all the information that they needed,
well, let's not just say just legal liability, risk mitigation, risk management. So they're not just worried about liability for this incident or even future incidents. Those investigations are motivated about trying to understand what happened so that they can try and prevent something like that happening again.
Yeah, they want to protect their students and their staff. So we'll roll all that together. So if that's what they're primarily concerned about, should they have accepted Michael's offer for him to answer questions in writing? Could that have accomplished functionally the same thing as them interviewing him in person?
Probably. Those sort of written examinations in civil litigation, we call those interrogatories, very standard part of both litigation and informal investigations of this sort. When Michael responded to Bells, he listed four conditions under which he'd be willing to cooperate with the investigation. I believe at this point we're now into 1991. And three of the four were just bare bones. This is how written examinations with attorneys happen. Totally unremarkable. But the third one was, oh yeah, I'm not going to answer any question that might incriminate me. By this point, he's come around to his attorney's position and started taking his attorney's advice. That's also somewhat unremarkable. If this was a civil lawsuit, witness doesn't have to answer questions that would expose him to criminal liability. doesn't work quite the same way as it does in criminal cases, but that privilege is still there. But what that means is Covenant probably didn't stand to learn anything at that point. You know, could they have proceeded with a written examination? Sure. Was that an adequate substitute for an in-person interview? Maybe not, but it's certainly a good way of starting. If nothing else, they can do the written examination and decide whether it's worth pursuing something in person. That's often the way discovery happens in legal cases. But under the circumstances, it doesn't look to me like Covenant was actually going to learn anything that they didn't already know.
So then why were they pursuing him?
I don't know the answer to that. So it makes sense for them to have asked, if only to do their due diligence. It makes sense for Michael to say, I don't really want to do this. I'll do it in writing, but I'm not going to incriminate myself. And at that point, I think it also kind of makes sense for Covenant to decide not to bother, because any question to which they didn't already know the answer was probably not going to be answered. So just let it go. You know, this is sort of a tactical decision that the seminary seems to have made. Attorneys make similar decisions about discovery all the time. It's like, could I ask this question? Yeah. Is he answering it the way I want to? No, he's not being all that cooperative. Is it worth trying to force the issue? Well, probably not.
In the letters, Michael makes several references to Koistra and Chapel telling him that they think he's innocent. In Koistra's letters, I don't know that he goes as far as saying, I do not believe Michael is the murderer, but he certainly says there's been, you know, we have not assumed Michael's guilt. We have, you know, we've tried to protect Michael. So do you feel like if Covenant really believed that Michael was innocent, they should have done more for him?
I want to say yes, but I don't know how, because the seminary's ability to change the direction of a police investigation is basically non-existent. And as long as that investigation is laser focused on Michael, here we are. What are they supposed to do? I don't think they did themselves any favors, and I think that there seems to have been mixed messages. Again, you look at the impression that Michael quite clearly has, and you read these letters and say, yeah, okay, I think he's wrong about what's going on, but he comes by that impression honestly. But I do think that the seminary did give him bad advice on several occasions. I mean, again, understandable advice. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to lose. Sounds good. And people that have been socialized to trust authority figures, including the police, don't automatically understand that it's not true. But it isn't. It's hard to know what to make of that at this point. There's a lot of water under that bridge. But if we're looking to say, you know, this could have been done better, that could have been done better.